The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
It's impossible to know which of those bruises came from, you know, a beating versus falling down or being pushed down or something like that, especially with all the bruises on her knees. But she has a significant number of bruises.
On February 17, 1974, Carla Walker was abducted from the passenger side of her boyfriend's vehicle after a short struggle which left her boyfriend, Rodney McCoy, unconscious from having been bludgeoned with the butt of a pistol. The abduction took place at the Ridgely Brunswick Bowling Alley in Fort Worth, Texas, and after a remarkable search ensued to find the young woman, Carla's body was found about 10 miles away, nearly 4 days later, in a culvert off of a road leading to Benbrook Lake. For almost 44 years, the case has gone unsolved. We attempted to cover the case as extensively as possible over 7 episodes, and we implore those of you who haven't listened to go back and do so before continuing with this episode. Recently, we were given several documents pertaining to Carla Walker's case by attorney Kathleen Barnett, who worked with both the Walkers and retired Fort Worth Police Detective John Terrell in the early 2000s, and whose husband also happens to be Rodney McCoy's best friend. Terrell was, you'll recall from episode 4 of the podcast, a burglary detective who was fixated on the idea that a repeat criminal who he had arrested several times, kidnapped, sexually assaulted, and murdered Carla Walker. As with any case covered by Gone Cold podcast, when additional information is obtained, we feel it should be discussed. These documents are files that Terrell collected, including correspondence with Texas government officials and various figures within the Fort Worth Police Department, most of which were done after Terrell retired. Other pages, ranging from a witness identification form to Terrell's suspect's polygraph results, are contained within as well. Carla's autopsy report was also included in Terrell's files, which had been given to Terrell by Carla's mother, Doris Walker. Before reviewing that particular document, though, I'd like to discuss some of the others. Some of the following information was also taken from a copy of what John Terrell called a condensed version of his investigation, also given to Mrs. Walker, which we obtained from the family not long after we began initial research on the case. It reads somewhat like a memoir. It's easy to get pulled into the John Terrell lone crusader for justice narrative. Not only was he the sole individual, other than the family, publicly fighting for answers in Carla Walker's case well after his retirement, he was also doing it vigorously and passionately. He liked to call out the system for what he deemed mistakes or inconsistencies in investigating. Terrell was written up with unfettered praise several times by seemingly star-struck local journalists who appeared to believe that the retired detective hung the moon, like he was the Andy Taylor to the Fort Worth Police Department's Barney Fife. Or perhaps it was the fact that the Terrell narrative read like a newsstand detective magazine story. Either way, his investigation was written as gospel by several local news sources. Admittedly, I marveled at John Terrell's persona, circumstantial evidence, and theory upon their face value. Working through Carla's case for the podcast, however, and researching Terrell's suspect, William Ted Wilhoit, shed new light on his theory. It's important to heavily scrutinize John Terrell's detective work, not because we believe his intentions were less than admirable, or that his dedication to the Walker family wasn't outstanding, but because his theory has become what Fort Worth residents and beyond have heard for 30-something years now. It's been drilled into the public's head until several aspects, if not all, have become thought of as the facts of the case. Terrell had a substantial portion of the local public believing that the evidence against his suspect was strong and court-worthy, that he had found Carla's killer, but for some reason, suggested by Terrell as a personal vendetta against him at times, the Fort Worth Police Department wasn't interested in his thoughts or theories. It's not difficult to imagine that the ego of veteran and local legend homicide detectives in Fort Worth made them less than ready to listen to a burglary detective. We were assured by Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Jim Minter, though, that Detective George Hudson of the Fort Worth Police was diligent about Carla's case to the point that it consumed him at times, and that they pored over every single lead that came their way. So, did John Terrell hinder the investigation of the murder of Carla Walker more than aid it? The first thing that made me have serious doubts about him was the fact that he claims to have been offered a transfer to homicide, but decided against it as he was contemplating retirement at the time. If he had transferred, Terrell would have gained access to Carla Walker's case file, something he'd been seeking obsessively for years at that point, but was denied every time. This could only have proved fruitful to his investigation, whether in the form of substantiation or elimination. Was he afraid of what he would find, what he wouldn't find? I still have trouble wrapping my brain around why he would decline. Another seemingly inconspicuous detail in the form of a question had me wondering about Terrell's investigative prowess. In his memoir-like account of his investigation, he asks, why was the Carla Walker case handled by the Fort Worth police when her body was found in the county? This seems like a reasonable question for a civilian to ponder. I certainly did when I asked a Tarrant County Sheriff's officer the same thing. His answer made perfect sense, though. He informed me that since the only known crime, the abduction, took place in Fort Worth, the jurisdiction belonged to them. Terrell also relied heavily on William Ted Wilhoit's supposed words upon approaching him for arrest for burglary. I was wondering when you were going to come after me for Carla Walker, Terrell documents Wilhoit as saying. While this so-called admission seems incredibly damning, Terrell never seems to entertain another notion. In July of 1974, an abduction and sexual assault of a buddy's grocery store clerk took place where the attacker, Terrell claims, was identified as Wilhoit by his collection of mugshots 28 years later. The clerk says the man told her that he had killed two girls and dumped their bodies in culverts as an attempt to keep the woman from struggling, referring likely to both Carla Walker and Becky Martin, whose badly decomposed body was also found in a culvert more than a month after she disappeared. If this was indeed Wilhoit, was his remark to Terrell about Carla Walker made because he'd bragged about the publicly known cases as a weapon against his victims, a method for subduing them? Did Wilhoit even really make the remark? Oddly, Terrell notes the sexual assault charges in this case were dropped. We were unable to find any record of the crime through newspapers, and the Fort Worth Police Department has absolutely no record of the assault occurring, not even an initial report, so it can be only reported through Terrell's lens. According to Terrell, in late 1994 or early 1995, Wilhoit, who was paroled at the time, was granted a travel permit to come to Fort Worth to attend the funeral of a family member. Terrell claims that it is reported to him that Wilhoit insisted traveling to a family property in Granbury, which was secluded and heavily wooded, and returned from the property barely in time for the funeral. His clothes, quote, very dirty and messed up. This event, Terrell suggests, was Wilhoit returning to the property to dispose of evidence. Terrell gives absolutely no indication in his own notes as to who gave him this information, and it is worrisome that he couldn't even nail down when the event supposedly took place, given that funerals and obituaries were still regularly announced in the papers at the time, providing crystal clear documentation. The intention here is not to somehow protect the name of William Ted Wilhoit. He is certainly his own monster. But to provide a dissent to Terrell's incomplete portrayal of the known facts of this investigation, to make those who champion his evidence aware that it may not be evidence at all, merely hearsay believed by an officer, and later retired officer, hell-bent on a suspect who has, according to former police chief J.D. Thornton, been cleared by DNA. A retired FBI agent who I spoke with reviewed documents we sent and took it upon himself to dig a little deeper. He came to the conclusion that Terrell was wearing blinders. Justice for Carla Walker will not be had for the Walker family if an attempt to eliminate a suspect isn't the first tool utilized in an investigation of them. Before we go further down the John Terrell rabbit hole, it might be important to discuss Carla's autopsy report. We'd like to share a forensic pathologist's explanations of some of the details that require a professional insight. Grace Dukes is a medical examiner / forensic pathologist for the state of Georgia and Atlanta. Her credentials are extremely impressive, and her help with deciphering Carla's autopsy report was vital to our understanding of exactly what we were looking at. According to the toxicology report, Carla had alcohol in her system. I asked Grace to explain the possibilities of this finding.
So a certain amount of alcohol is produced in your body after you die due to decomposition. So the level that was described is a little bit on the higher end of what could be found in a postmortem specimen due to decomposition, but it's certainly within reason. So I think that that's probably most consistent with the fact that she was dead for a couple of days.
As we discussed in prior episodes, morphine was also found in Carla's system. This detail wasn't released to the public at large until the early 90s. And it can be said with confident presumption that John Terrell is responsible for leaking this information to the press.
So I see that there's a result for urine, which is positive for morphine and then described as suspicious. And then there's a result for blood. But it looks to me like he was writing micrograms. And it's usually, you know, milligrams or micrograms per deciliter or per, there are different units that can be used. It looks like it's micrograms. And if that's the case, and that was in the blood, then that would be a low level. But if it is micrograms, because the M looks different than the M elsewhere on the report, so it makes me think he was writing a mu for micrograms. It looks like they found something in the urine, didn't have enough of the specimen to quantitate it, and so they tested it in the blood and got a level. But it looks to me like he was probably writing micrograms. Again, it's hard to be sure. So there are a couple different things that could happen. You know, it could have been metabolized by her when she was alive, and there is some metabolism that can happen after death. There's also a phenomenon called redistribution, where the drug can sort of, after someone's circulation stops, the drug can seep out of tissues and redistribute back into the vessels. And so for that reason, it can depend on which area you're sampling the blood from. But yes, I mean, a certain amount of those changes can happen.
Grace went on to discuss the contents of Carla's stomach.
It was described as liquid and partially digested food, I think, which is a common description used in autopsy reports because the contents of the stomach are almost always, you know, food particles mixed with a liquid. And, you know, either that liquid was ingested with the food or afterwards, or there's a certain amount of liquid, you know, in the stomach. The fact that it was liquefied, and it sounds like there were still food particles present, that would be a normal finding in a stomach. And unfortunately, it doesn't tell you a whole lot about when she died, because we also don't know what the starting volume was.
Carla sustained substantial bruising, either while she was being abducted, while she was being sexually assaulted, or during the period in which she was held in captivity. Though some details are not expounded on in the report, Grace walks me through why it is difficult to determine just what Carla endured, as well as some of the language that was used.
It's hard to define badly beaten because she has bruising on her face, neck, shoulders, hips, legs. It sounds like thighs and knees. It's impossible to know which of those bruises came from, you know, a beating versus falling down or being pushed down or something like that, especially with all the bruises on her knees. But she has a significant number of bruises. The autopsy report describes bruises in the femoral area. And if you think about how hard it is to get, you know, a bruise on your thigh, sometimes there's deeper tissues, it's harder to get bruising on. So she's got bruising all over her thighs and hips. And the ones on the shoulders, it sounds like were not that remarkable, but they were there. I mean, she got them somehow. You know, there was injury somehow, whether he was handling her or had hit her or something like that. But I don't really know how to define badly beaten.
Felix Gwotes, Tarrant County Chief Medical Examiner at the time, listed Carla's time of death as 2 to 3 days before her body was found. She was found, to give a more precise, though not absolute idea, approximately 3 days and 18 hours after she was abducted. Grace gave us insight on how Gwotes made this determination by discussing the lack of rigor mortis noted at the time of the autopsy.
So it was described as a complete absence, and then it said, most notably in the lower extremities, rigor mortis will develop starting very soon after death. Will start developing, you know, over 6 to 12 hours. Around 12 hours, it will be, you know, fully developed, assuming there aren't some, you know, extreme external factors like, you know, heat or cold or anything like that. You know, heat would speed the process, cold would slow the process. And then there is also anything that was going on within her body. You know, if she were septic, that would speed the process. Anything that raises core body temperature. If you take stimulant drugs, that can raise your core body temperature. And then all that would speed the process along. But generally, you know, it's thought to be fixed around about, you know, 12-ish hours. It dissipates over a period of 36 to 48 hours, usually. So it'll peak, and then it'll remain, and then it'll dissipate over a couple of days. So that would, if she were dead 2 to 3 days, you would expect Ryder to have passed at that point for the most part. The weather got kind of warm during the day, but she, it sounds like, was in a covered area. If there were water flowing, then the water would have a lower temperature than the air, so that might cool her a bit. The problem is that once Ryder has passed, it's passed. So if she had been dead for 2 days, it would, you know, in terms of Ryder, it would be the same as if she had been dead 7 days. But I think it's all consistent with 2 or 3 days. The problem is estimation of time of death is a vague science.
We also asked about the amount of semen found in Carla's vagina.
I found a figure that said the average volume of semen in a single ejaculation is 3.7 milliliters. I think it's probably fair to say it's somewhere from, you know, 2 to 4 or, you know, in that range. 1 cc, which is 1 milliliter, is not a lot, you know, and there's a certain amount that will sort of drain out or be cleared by the body's own cleaning mechanisms during life. And then a certain amount of it will just get broken down and absorbed. It's hard to know how much would be left and unabsorbed in a person who is already dead. Because none of those mechanisms are happening. But it's consistent with a portion of a normal volume of ejaculate. And some could leak out just by, you know, repositioning her body. We don't know how much she was moved around. I agree that she was probably dead 2 to 3 days. And so if that's the case, definitely some could have leaked.
The medical examiner listed Carla's death as the result of asphyxiation by strangulation. And, of course, the evidence of this was consistent with that determination.
If a ligature had been used, there would probably be more concentric bruising or more of an evidence of bruising sort of around more of her neck, because it sounds like bruising was just described on the right and left sides of her neck in the carotid areas, and the thyroid cartilage was fractured. So that, to me, sounds like there was force on two sides of her neck. Meaning someone was potentially squeezing her airway or pressing on it in a way that it caused force to be on both sides of her airway to be able to fracture the cartilage like that. It's hard to know considering that it's vague, confluent bruising, you know, no description of any finger nail marks or any, you know, distinct bruising that would look like fingertips or anything like that. But yeah, it sounds like there was a significant force placed on her airway enough to cause a fracture. But there were no, there weren't markings all the way around her neck or even sort of in a line on her skin. It sounds like there was force applied to two sides of her neck. Because there aren't injuries described in the midline of her neck, you know, or on the back of her neck or anything like that. The hemorrhaging in the eyes described as petechial hemorrhages are little pinpoint hemorrhages, and they come from little capillary breaks that cause, you know, very localized bleeding. And there are a couple of factors at play here. I think there were petechial hemorrhages described on the surfaces of the lungs as well. When hypoxia occurs, meaning, you know, the tissues are not getting oxygenated, the capillaries will dilate, and that makes them, you know, more prone. If there's some sort of congestion in them, that makes them more prone to break. But that's why you can get those petechial hemorrhages in organs as well. If it's in a hypoxic environment, which would be consistent with her being strangled. The other thing is that, especially in her eyes, the reason we look so carefully in eyes and oral mucosa for petechial hemorrhages in strangulation cases is that you have a few major vessels that go through your neck, and there are arteries and veins. And you can compress the veins easily, just like in your arm. It takes more force to compress the arteries. So what happens is there's blood being pumped up to the head through the arteries with some force, and the veins can easily be occluded, but a lot of times there is arterial blood that's still going through to the head. So it's basically just being pumped up there and can't get out. So those capillaries get congested and they can break and cause those petechial hemorrhages. If she was being strangled, it takes a couple of minutes. It takes a matter of seconds for someone to lose consciousness, but could take more like, you know, a couple of minutes for someone to actually die, a couple of minutes or more. So if the organs are experiencing hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen to the tissues, then what I was describing earlier about the dilation of the vessels, and they'll get congested. The vessels are dilating because the organs want more blood flowing to them because they're not getting enough oxygen. And then so those organs will get congested, meaning more blood is flowing to them, more fluid is pooling in them, and it can cause breaks like that, like the capillary breaks. It's definitely consistent with a strangulation.
On part two of this episode, we'll talk with Darren Dake, the founder of the Death Investigation Training Academy and voice behind the podcast Coroner Talk, about Carla Walker's autopsy report. Though mostly consistent with what Grace Dukes told us, Darren's 30-plus years in criminal investigations gives us a look at some possibilities as to what befell Carla 44 years ago.
And again, all that's subjective. In death investigation, there's a lot of things that are subjective, because weather and the person's size and if they're on prescription medication or if they've got some kind of disease, all that can change. And so that's why these things are in hours and not specifically it's this time and that time, because there's, you know, there's a lot of factors that we don't know here.
If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, Carla Walker Episode 8, Terrell's Files, Part 2. We'd like to thank Kathleen Barnett for sharing John Terrell's files with us, and Grace Dukes for her fascinating insight into the autopsy report. And, of course, we'd like to thank the Walker family for their unwavering and continued support. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about these cases and post pictures, so please join in. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Carla's story with a friend, or by stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. If you enjoy true crime, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. Like us, the True Crime Files is passionate about unsolved cases, handling them in rich detail, with interesting insight, and respect to the victims. Trust us, you won't be disappointed. Also, if Texas true crime is your thing, then head over to cowtowncrime.com, where you'll find blog posts about many cases from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and podcast reviews as well. And finally, we'd like to present a promo for our friend Jamie's podcast, Murderish. She does an amazing job presenting the cases she covers. We love it. We think you will too. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hey everyone, I'm Jamie, and I host a podcast called Murderish, which takes you inside stories of murder and other creepy events. The first episode of Murderish lets listeners be a fly on the wall for a first-degree murder trial. The story is told from a juror's perspective, as I was that juror. If you are a true crime junkie and need to know every detail, you'll feel right at home with this podcast. Follow Murderish on Twitter at Murderish Pod and on Facebook at Murderish Podcast. And don't worry, this doesn't mean you're a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish.